Joe, how you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. So glad to be here tonight. And I have, it's kind of a boring story. So can I just tell it and get it out of the way?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. So this week, I got delivery of a fancy electric car, a Tesla. So it also coincided with the opening, actually, it's, I think about a week ago, of Highway 1, the Big Sur Highway. And so we decided we would take a road trip through Big Sur. And so I said, yeah, that's a good idea. Kind of test the car out, you know, those roads, kind of just sort of, you know, a romantic idea. What a nightmare. There was like, I felt I was in Beijing. There was like 5,000 buses, you know, and we went to this restaurant, this famous hippie restaurant called Nepenthe, and you couldn't even get into the parking lot. And so, you know, my the thing that I was really kind of shocked by is I'd never really noticed one thing: how big Esalen is. Esalen is, I don't know, it's hundreds of square acres. Did you know that? I thought it was this little like hole in the wall place.
Yeah, I figured it was just a building on a hill or something.
It's huge. It's hundreds of square acres. And so that was, I think, sort of a clue as to the power of the thing. But we made it back safe and sound. And we found in our trip through Big Sur, not a single Holocaust denier. Not one.
Did you canvass them?
Well, I was going to arrest someone. Citizens arrest. But fortunately, the Chinese tourists and the kind of San Francisco, how would you call them, kind of aging hippie, they were all of a single mind. All of a single mind, Tim.
No free thinkers among them?
I guess not. But I've been wondering about it. And I was wondering, could you kind of help us understand some of the historical background of the H word?
The H word. Denying the H?
Yeah, because there is this, as you know, there are all these laws. In fact, you know, because we were going to talk about it tonight, I had no idea. I went to Wikipedia. All things Wikipedia, Tim. And I went there and I looked at Holocaust denial laws. It's about like, you know, like 10 pages long. But there are like dozen or 17 countries that have different laws. And it's very complicated, very technical. The laws are different, you know, one country to the next. But anyway, how did they come about? It just seems so odd to have a law to make it basically illegal to have an opinion about, you know, historical event.
Especially a very complex historical
event. Yeah, such a complex one. So can you, I mean, what should a person know to get started understanding about the H word?
Well, H denial.
Yeah.
Well, heck, Holocaust denial.
Okay, let's just say it.
Do your worst. I don't plan on going to Germany anytime soon. Holocaust denial. Wikipedia, of course. The denial of systematic genocidal killing of approximately 6 million Jews in Europe by Nazi Germany in the 1930s and 1940s. Is illegal in 16 countries. In Israel, shock. Many countries have also broader laws that criminalize genocidal denial. Of the countries that ban Holocaust denial, some of them, such as Austria, Germany, Hungary, Romania, were among the perpetrators of the Holocaust. And many of those also ban other elements associated with Nazism, such as expressions of Nazi symbols, you know, I guess like the swastika. Laws against Holocaust denial have been proposed in many nations, in addition to those nations that have criminalized such acts, including the United States and the United Kingdom. Such proposals for laws have received criticism and faced opposition, most significantly from civil rights and human rights advocates, who contend that such laws would violate people's established rights of freedom of speech and freedom of expression. Organizations representing Jews and other groups victimized during the Holocaust have generally been split in opinion about such laws. Scholars have pointed out that countries that specifically ban Holocaust denial generally have legal systems that limit speech in other ways, such as banning hate speech. According to D.D. Guttenplan, this is the split between the common law countries of the United States, Ireland, and many British Commonwealth countries from the civil laws countries of continental Europe and Scotland. Well, the argument that laws punishing the Holocaust now are incompatible with the European Convention on Human Rights and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights have been rejected by institutions by the Council of Europe, the European Commission of Human Rights, and the European Court of Human Rights, and also by the United Nations Rights and Committee. Such critics of these laws include, Noam Chomsky. Noam Chomsky, I think, says, "It seems to me something of a scandal that is even necessary to debate these issues 2 centuries after Voltaire defended the right of free expression for views he detested. It is a poor service to the memory of the victims of the Holocaust to adopt central doctrine of their murderers." Countries that include that have laws criminalizing Holocaust denial are Australia. It has a specific law of Holocaust denial. Australia also has other laws against hate speech and racial vilification. Austria has a law dating back to 1947. It provides a legal framework for the process of denazification. Of course, Belgium has a law against Holocaust denial. Czech Republic, and of course there's Germany, and Germany's law is primarily based on incitement to hatred and also the so-called disparagement of the memory of deceased persons. That law was passed as recently as 1985. Israel, of course, passed their law as recently as 1986. Italy actually didn't pass law until 2007. The Netherlands has a law. Poland recently passed a law of Holocaust denial, also a law making it criminal to call it the Polish Holocaust. You have to be specific. You have to blame it on Nazi Germany. Portugal, interesting enough, does not expressly ban Holocaust denial, but it does prohibit speech that denies war crimes and incitements to discrimination. Spain, interesting enough, had a law, and its Constitutional Court of Spain ruled that the words deny were unconstitutional in its judgment of November 7, 2007. As a result, historical denial is legal in Spain, although justifying the Holocaust for any other genocide is considered an offense punishable by imprisonment. Switzerland has a law against Holocaust denial. The European Union tried to pass a universal law against Holocaust denial, but it was rejected. They try to pass extradition laws that like England or something. If you're in England, you deny the Holocaust, Germany could extradite you or something if you were caught denying the Holocaust. Such people who have been prosecuted for Holocaust denial include Jean-Marie Le Pen, Gerhard Förster in Switzerland. Notably, Frederick Tobin in Australia. He was actually imprisoned in Germany for 7 months. Then it was declared a mistrial. Then I think, infamously, Germany tried to extradite him when he was in the United Kingdom. United Kingdom refused. David Irving, of course, is a well-known victim of Holocaust denial laws. He was in prison for 3 years and released and deported after serving 13 months for denying Holocaust. Of course, there's Germar Rudolph, the German citizen who... denied the Holocaust after performing various tests in Auschwitz, I guess involving Zyklon B and the lack of what's the chemical compound that he has?
Arsenic?
Of course, there's Sylvia Stoll. She was the lawyer of Ernst Zundel, and she went to jail for defending her client Ernst Zundel, who also was deported from Canada, then deported from the United States and forced back to Germany to face trial for Holocaust denial, where he suffered many years in solitary confinement. Most recently, there's Ursula Haverback, an 80-year-old woman who denied the Holocaust in Germany, and she's sitting in prison. So these laws exist, and they're a problem because history itself is very complicated without getting the police involved in it, right? So you arrest people for simply having a different opinion on a certain historical event or narrative. So that's kind of the issue there. Now, interesting enough, the laws, you can deny other massacres or genocides and not face imprisonment. And I ran across this interesting letter, an open letter to Deborah Lipstadt, the historian who was sued by David Irving for libel a while back. And this is what he writes. Miss Lipstadt, I'll highlight the parts of it. It says, Miss Lipstadt, consider the book by Israeli historian Uri Milstein, The Birth of the Palestinian Nation, The Myth of Deir Yassin Massacre, which argues that the Deir Yassin Massacre of Arabs by Jewish Zionists was a myth. Notice the hypocritical double standard at work here. Western society and Israel consider it morally acceptable for a Jewish intellectual to attempt to repudiate and debunk a claim that Arabs were massacred and murdered at Deir Yassin by Jews, regardless of the fact that of the feelings and the sensibilities of the Palestinian Arabs are offended in the process. There is no taboo here in the United States that prevents Jewish people from questioning the history of that event. To my knowledge, there are no Deir Yassin denial laws in Europe or Israel that imprison Jews or others who question it. Nevertheless, there are Holocaust denial laws in Israel and throughout Europe and strictly enforced taboos in the United States that prevent people from questioning or debunking the Holocaust, the alleged massacre of Jews by Germans, and there is even more to consider. Many Gypsy Roma people claim that the Third Reich committed genocide against their people. Another Jewish intellectual, Gerthner Louis, wrote a lengthy tome entitled The Nazi Persecution of Gypsies, which was published by the very distinguished academic publishing house Oxford University Press, that debunked this claim. This shows it is morally acceptable in our society to debunk the genocide claims of the Gypsy Roma people, regardless of the fact that this offends many of them. Nevertheless, Oxford University Press would not dare publish a book that repudiates the debunks of Jewish Holocaust. Undoubtedly, in their view, it would be morally repugnant and anti-Semitic prejudice to critique and undermine the traditional Jewish Holocaust story. Oxford University Press would not dare offend the feelings and sensibilities of Jews by publishing a Holocaust denial book. And there is still more. According to France's highest court, a law that forbids the denial of the Armenian genocide by the Turks is unconstitutional. Nevertheless, laws that forbid the denial of the Jewish Holocaust are supposedly constitutionally valid. The article states that France's highest court ruled as follows on the law that forbids denial of the Armenian genocide by Turks. The council ruled that the law, which would have imposed a €45,000 fine, a one-year prison sentence, or both, on genocide deniers, ran against the principles of freedom of expression written in France's founding documents. Once again, an Armenian genocidal law violates the French constitution, but a Jewish Holocaust denial law does not violate the same constitution. France has strict laws that forbid anyone from debunking Jewish Holocaust claims. In effect, in France, the feelings and beliefs of Jews are raised above those of Armenians. Finally, consider this. Former President of the United States Jimmy Carter claimed that 5 million non-Jews were allegedly murdered by the Nazis in the concentration camps. Jewish Holocaust historian Deborah Lipstadt debunked and repudiated this claim in the Eichmann trial. She says that it was the myth invented by Simon Wiesenthal. Once again, this demonstrates how Jewish intellectuals such as yourself have infused the Holocaust issue with a hypocritical double standard. According to your criteria as presented in the Eichmann trial, it is morally acceptable to question, debate, and repudiate the story that the Nazis murdered 5 million non-Jews, yet according to the same standards presented in the Eichmann trial, that the Nazis murdered 6 million Jews is not a matter of debate. It is an established fact that needs no validation. These four examples show how international Zionist power elite has inculcated Western public consciousness with their own hypocritical double standard in regards to Holocaust ideology. If I am in error on any matter, please correct me. Paul Grubeck. Sorry for the long read, but I figured that kind of, well, it speaks for itself. So I'll let you talk now, Joe.
No, I mean, that was fascinating, and actually learned quite a lot in that. I'd like you, would you mind repeating it?
Oh, yeah.
No, it was very, very important stuff. Okay, first of all, I was arrested because I denied the Norman invasion. And I think I was also arrested because I denied the Sioux invasion of Custer's 7th Cavalry.
Yes.
I mean, so the thing is that there seems to be an odd situation here where, particularly when if you look at the laws, they are focused on this idea of hate and creating violence. Right. That's how they justify the existence of the laws, typically. You know, and incidentally, it's kind of a lawyer's I hate to use the expression, but wet dream to have all these laws because they're so vague that you can almost arrest anyone on them. Did you go through them, Tim, and look at how like the,
Yeah,
you
it's
know, they are
incitement to
just,
hatred.
yeah,
Yeah.
excite hatred,
Some of
it.
them you have to be in conjunction with incitement. We're just saying it, but if you're, I guess if you're protesting or something,
Yeah,
it's
someone who publicly declares sympathy with a movement that might provoke hatred against another group. I mean, you know, it's like I couldn't even get out of bed in the morning if I was trying to comply with it.
it's like
I mean, like I my you know, like my neighbors would arrest me like getting the newspaper. So they're absurd and they're obviously. I mean, I look at this and I just go, you know, there's no way these are serious laws. It's first of all, what was the criminal threat that the laws were created to stop? I mean, were there, nascent Nazi parties springing up? I mean, this is really, and if they were, how are these laws going to stop that, right? It's just so the laws make no sense to me just from the perspective of civil order, right? So something else is going on, and I think you in the quote you clearly pointed out what's happening is that these things are just set up to intimidate. I mean, I think even the people who created the laws would admit this, right? That they simply want people to not think about the Holocaust as a technical historical issue with nuance, because that's really kind of what they want to do. And yet, in my opinion, what I would say is that we're in a post-911 world, folks. Post-911 world, and buildings don't fall straight down at free fall speed unless there is controlled demolition. That's just a matter of physics. And so,
And bodies don't burn easy.
and bodies don't burn very easily. I've only tried it like a couple times in the last week, but kidding. Just kidding. Okay, I make a joke from time to time. But in any case, the thing is that post 911, you've got to be more skeptical, right? Those of us who are on the side of the accepting the conspiracy theory of the government, basically. We are just by definition less able to buy any historical narrative, period. And particularly the Holocaust because of its obvious cultural power. I mean, if there was ever a historical element that needed really close scrutiny, this would be it. And that's why it's just fascinating. You look at like David Irvin, and you look at how technical his analysis was of why the Holocaust, as it was presented, was basically propaganda.
Yeah, then he's called an idiot for being thorough.
And so, and then you, and but you see, this has to be. There's just something wrong here analytically because they want this to be the most important cultural power that exists, right? You've got the Holocaust museums, and if you ever notice when you get like a government puppet on TV, they'll say, well, that individual is a terrible, crazy person because he denies the moon landings and the Holocaust, right? Or they'll lump it into, believes in UFOs and the Holocaust didn't exist, right? So they
And
have this,
they throw in Bigfoot.
yeah, Bigfoot. So they are this is they have this crude mind control to keep the sheep in line so they don't move toward trying to analyze this thing as a technical historical event and trying to find, well, are some of the elements propaganda? Because see, this is the thing, and I can see why, we were talking before the show, like, well, why did the laws even start to come about? It's because they gotta stop it from ever being analyzed at all. It's like 911. I mean, you cannot have technical analysis of this thing. Because what happens is, even though I am positive there were Jews in camps, and I am positive some were were killed or died during this period. When you start going into the technical analysis of the thing, of like, okay, well, you know, what did the Red Cross come up with for a number of Jews who died in the camp following World War II? The Red Cross was permitted into the camps. They had the capacity to do census. So what was their number? Well, they came up with this number of 130,000. Now, say that is the correct number. Well, why would the 6 million number then be presented? Well, there's propaganda, right? So in other words, if the Red Cross was correct, then the obvious explanation for the 6 million number is that this was propaganda. And this is my point.
Yeah.
They can never permit any aspect of the Holocaust narrative to be understood as propaganda. They can never permit it, not a single thing. Because if it is, then people will start walking down the whole narrative trying to, you know, figure out, well, were the gas chambers propaganda? Were the shrunken heads propaganda? You know, were the human skin lampshades propaganda? Once you demonstrate that a single aspect was used for propaganda, then you are at the point where you go, well, you know, why do we let then the Holocaust have the weight that it does culturally? If elements in it were propaganda, right, then why do we have permit it to have the weight? And as soon as you're there, as soon as the mind of the European is questioning the degree that the propaganda exists within the Holocaust narrative, it's over. It doesn't work any longer. You see what I mean? It has to be black and white in order for it to work as propaganda.
Yeah.
In order for it to work as intimidation. If you are in flux, if you are questioning the technical aspects of the Jewish incarceration by the Nazis during World War II, if you're technically analyzing it, that means you're thinking. You know? And that's just doesn't work for the propagandists. And so that's why when, you know, to my mind, there's so many things that you just the question is there anything that basically rise to the level where you have to start thinking about them? You just cannot accept the historical narrative. In fact, man, everything just about falls apart when you start looking at it. The number 6 million, as you well know, was used, I don't know, 30 times before World War II in newspaper stories about the threat that the Germans posed to the Jewish people.
Yeah.
6 million is a... You know, it's a number that has significance. The Jewish race was characterized in the Old Testament as 600,000 men. And so 10 times that is 6 million. And so somehow the 6 million number got into vogue. And then that was the miraculous number that, you know, contradicted the Red Cross's number following the war. If you look at the Shrunken Heads, C.D. Jackson's presentation. I mean, it's just ludicrous, right? And it's very important because even though it's stupid, it shows that from the very beginning, this was as the camps are being opened up, that they already had a propaganda narrative that was being presented, right? If you look at the scene where Billy Wilder reshoots a starving concentration camp guy, it's on YouTube, you know, he does it. He comes out. The guy, Wilder, doesn't like the scene. He pushes him back in, and the guy comes out again looking even more haggard. So it's propaganda. And, of course, why would you, if you're trying to record history, why would you have Billy Wilder and Alfred Hitchcock as your film guys? You know, yeah, it's absurd.
The psycho and then, director and the psycho of the 7 year olds, right, and psycho.
And then finally, and I'll shut up, is that, I mean, why would you have Ewan Cameron be the chief psychologist to give the world an understanding of the psychological nature of the German people, right, which is directly related to the Holocaust narrative, right? This was the Germans being evil and bloodthirsty and psychopaths would be good soldiers and carry out the orders of the maniac Nazis. And so the whole race was bad, and Cameron was there talking about, you know, that the German people were basically psychopaths. And this was just, you know, basically a few years before he began his experiments on humans where he was killing people right and left and psychic driving their consciousness out of their body to try to make women forget their children. I mean, just read about Ewan Cameron and Wikipedia, even there you can see that this is not someone that it is possible, right, to take seriously in terms of his understanding of anything. And so the idea that it was accidental that he shows up, and it wasn't accidental, I don't think, that Bernays's nephew, Sigmund Freud's great nephew, then was the lawyer in charge of the Nuremberg trial. So these are just some of the things that, you know, bring about a need to do technical analysis. And by that, I mean just an analysis of what the evidence is for each of the aspects, each of the things, the shrunken head, the human lampshade, the 6 million number, the gas chamber. I mean, you need to do analysis of all these things. And if you start that process, if you're involved with it, then you're out of the mind control, right? By definition, you're thinking. And that's why these laws exist. And it's why, you know, this show will probably be banned, because you cannot ever permit the mind controlled to start a technical analysis of the narrative that they are controlled by, because their mind starts to activate. And then they start going, well, if this is fake, why should I believe that? Why should I believe this? You know, and so, and then suddenly the burden is proof is upon, you know, to like, well, where's the evidence for all this? And now you're back to the 911 point. Tim, the burden is on them after 911. It's like we had the show about the space, the moon landing, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know the moon landing from Adam. I know that after 911, I don't believe a damn thing they say. I want to see some evidence, right? I don't want to see some grainy films with the guys hopping around that Kubrick could do better than. That doesn't convince me of anything, right? So this is the thing in terms of the H word, is that the, you know, there is enough clear-cut kind of question marks about all these things. The burden is placed back on those who want to make the case. They need to say, okay, we need to find some way to go through all of these things, open it up, go through the details, and see what they come up with. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I'm amazed that, you know, many historians and researchers who pride themselves on detail, their standards for scholarship and documentation and proof for this narrative seems to be lacking, or at least seems to be a much lower standard. And this is a function of intimidation, because whenever you confront some of these researchers with the lack of evidence, I don't want to hear about it. I'm bored with the story. I don't want to talk about it. And then accuse you of being a Nazi or have some sympathies for National Socialism or hatred of peoples and, or of Jews in general. I mean, you're simply just asking for the evidence and applying critical thought to this narrative. I mean, the final solution narrative is that the Germans, in prosecuting their war, carried out a planned annihilation of European Jewry. Any Jew was in their grasp, they sought to murder, to get rid of. They get rid of European Jewry. And the reality is there isn't any evidence to back that up. There's no documentation, there's no orders in these things. If you just consider the fact that I think Auschwitz itself, which is now sort of a theme park, you know, where they the Israeli government will send Israeli school children to Poland to visit, and people go, make their pilgrimages to this new holy site of the Jewish religion, the park itself is revisionist, because at one time it claimed 4 million Jews died there, and now it's down to less than 1 million. How do you lose 3 million deaths and maintain the same narrative? Because I know you can say it's a numbers game or arguing numbers. No, but at a certain point when you find evidence or lack evidence and the numbers start to be in hundreds of thousands as opposed to millions, yeah, that's grim. It's a grim number, and we can talk about why they died, how they died, who did it, and who's responsible. But you get the numbers that are low enough where it's something entirely different than the final solution, at least how the final solution is understood the standard historical account, the official narrative of the Second World War. You can't have those numbers. You can't have hundreds of thousands die because of conditions in the camp. They also tend to take disparate parts of the war and think it's part of the same plan. A good example is the Einsatzgruppen in Eastern Europe or in Russia, these special police battalions who went around. These were counterinsurgency divisions that went around, and they massacred a whole lot of people, a lot of Jews, a lot of communists in these years. And you had the anti-Commissar act, which was meant to murder communists during the Russian war, the German invasion of Russia, and a lot of Jews died in the process of this. And there were a lot of massacres. And this is going to happen in warfare. But they tend to loop that in with the Final Solution. It's a completely different event. Had nothing to do with what was going on in the camps, like Auschwitz, which by and large was an industrial camp using slave labor, impressed labor in these things. It's kind of gets thrown into the mush. And again, this is where nuance and detail gets tossed aside. Doesn't matter. We have our narrative of evil Germany, and that's all that matters. And, you know, throw an example of, I'm sure the war could be brutal and many deaths are going to occur because this from the disruption that war brings, the displacement of millions of people, they're going to be exposed. They're not going to have shelter. They're not going to have food or water. They're going to be sickened. They're going to die of disease and starvation related diseases and these things. And you won't have the same food distribution that was in place prior to the war, yet the population is still there. So you're going to have millions of people die, primarily children and the elderly, because they can't be soldiers, and women, because they're not combatants in these things. So horrible things are going to happen in these wars. Even in Russia, where you have some of the massacres going along, these are counterinsurgency operations. If you're wondering how that can happen, we'll just look at what the U.S. Army did, U.S. military did in Vietnam with the Phoenix program. And you can see how this can occur. And the Vietnam, in terms of, I guess, if you want to compare intensity of warfare, was nothing compared to what was going on in Eastern, in Russia, in Western Russia, 1941 through 1944. It was a huge war and very destructive. So a lot of people are going to die. So again, it's a very complicated issue. And if you start to look at the nuance and detail of this and start to question the evidence or lack thereof, you're accused of being either a Nazi sympathizer or having some sort of evil intent. At the same time, in some countries, in as many as 16 countries in the so-called free world, you can go to prison for it. And that's absurd. And that's, to me, this is kind of like low-hanging fruit. It's obvious. And most people kind of agree with it. So why do the laws persist? Why is there no outrage when someone is in prison for simply having a point of view? People say they're against it, but they don't get really outraged by it. They don't get outraged by it because it's politically incorrect to get outraged by it. Because the group that's supposedly being protected by it, it has special privileges based on its their official position as being history's victims. And in the 21st century, victimhood is power.
Sure. The thing that is pointed out often as evidence is the protocol that came from the Wannsee Conference.
Yeah, 1940, January 1942.
Yeah, and it was found in 1947 by Kempner, who is a Jewish attorney. I mean, amazing. and he found it in 1947. And so that was actually, I think it was brought into some of the Nuremberg issues, because, and then it became, kind of this, the idea of the final.
It's probably also Eichmann's trial.
Yeah, and then it was this idea of the final solution, that this was sort of planned. But the actual document that Kempner presented has been, looked at by experts, and they point out that, the number of Jews that are listed is not accurate. They have Jews for each country, and that whoever was putting this together seemed to have no understanding of this, didn't seem very, kind of having the information of a German bureaucrat at the high level. No one ever mentions anything about gas chambers or mass solutions in the thing. The actual marking indicates that it's a copy, but it seems to be in contradiction with normal German administrative procedure. And worse, it actually is not the actual minutes of the meeting. Is something that kind of amazed me when I was looking at this. It's a document that talks about a meeting and talks about the minutes, but isn't the minutes. So it's a copy of something.
So if this were like a court of law, it would have no evidentiary value whatsoever.
It wouldn't have any weight at all. I mean, just like I do a lot of what at least some people would disagree, but I would say is historical analysis, And I mean, I wouldn't ever use anything that, that had a provenance that was so question mark, so unclear. And so, but it has become basically a kind of element of propaganda. People say, well, there it is, there's the evidence. And that, and it has to do with, and the reason I'm bringing it up is not that it can be verified one way or another, right? It's impossible. There is a document. It is not a very good document. It is not a document that is actually, could be called autobiographical to the WANC conference. Is it, can it, can I prove it that it is false? That can I prove that it was created by Kempner as a propaganda piece? No, I can't. But he can't prove that there's anything real about the thing either. It just doesn't have enough substance to it. It isn't actually a document from the WANC meeting. It's just basically it was someone talking about the WANC conference. So it's one of these question marks, which, since the Holocaust is the most important cultural power, needs to allow itself to be held up to technical scrutiny. And this is, you can see how wrong our culture is at the moment. Because something like the WANC conference protocol, all of the problems with it, it's the fact that no one has even the slightest idea who wrote the thing, right? This begs to have more technical analysis done, but you won't find any major media source that has that does anything other than describe it as, well, there it is, it's proof that the final solution was actually, you know, authorized by the National Socialists. So we are in the grip of deliberate mind control propaganda. This is, I think, self-evident. Now, listeners of Powers and Principalities will even have a further question mark into all this, because, you know, we've talked about the origins of the Nazi Party before. And I think when you look at, you know, the evidence that the, you know, elite British Freemason circles were certainly creating Zionism, I don't think this can even be contested by anyone, but were also involved in the creation of the Nazi Party, because, as we showed, the you know, you have the swastika, the salute to the flag, the intense patriotism, the National Socialism, the Aryan supremacy. You have the Masonic swastika. You have the world leader, religious leader, and then you have the anti-Semitism through the coming, you know, from the protocols, the Elders of Zion. All of these things are coming out of the same group, every one of them. And then bear in mind that how is the Nazi Party getting funded? Well, it's through Montague Norman, Brown Brothers Harriman, the Warburg family, and the exact same group. Now, this cannot happen accidentally. There's too many disparate elements in the flow. And so, therefore, this process is best explained by the idea that World War II was like the movement of pieces on a chessboard. Mm-hmm. The idea was to, as I would see it, that they wanted to reduce European population, shatter European culture, and also create a structure for the insertion of the State of Israel. Both of these things were promoted by the group. Both of these things came to pass. And so the natural way of understanding is that, well, that's what they wanted to do because they brought it about. So this was the plan. But I don't have a WANC conference protocol minutes from Montague Norman and Adolf Hitler and, FDR about this. But, you can use that analysis to get to a pretty clear understanding. But anyway, long-winded here. But all of this then should make the listeners of our show even more curious to do technical analysis into the Holocaust. And I just wanted to link one final thing into that long chain of events that came out of the group, which was related to the Quattro Coronati, that led to both to the proto-Zionism, to the State of Israel, to the Nazi Party, and then into present day propaganda. There's one other thing, And that's the whole Holodomor. You know, we talked about Holocaust and genocide, which you can discuss or question, right? The Holodomor, which was a much bigger Holocaust, in my opinion, than the purported Jewish one, probably by a factor of two. I think the 6 million number, which doesn't seem to be able to be, supported, but nevertheless is given. The Holodomor looks like about 12 million people died, starved to death. And little known fact, it was supported because it was denied. It was denied by a guy named Walter Duranty. And he's a very important guy because he got a Pulitzer Prize. He worked for the New York Times. Remember, the New York Times was that organization that Belmont, the Rothschild agent, and Randolph was his name. No, excuse me. Jerome, who was then the father of Winston Churchill's mother, right? This bizarre connection between the Churchills and the Rothschild family. It exists in the New York Times. But the New York Times came to existence. They hired Walter Duranty, sent him to the Ukraine, and he wrote that the Holodomor was not happening. He denied it, right? He got a Pulitzer Prize for it. Now, why should that be something that's important for listeners in our show? Well, because, you see, Walter Duranty goes back to the same group that basically, you know, created the Nazi Party and the proto-Zionism and State of Israel. Walter Duranty, when he was a young man, worked with Aleister Crowley, right? The person who got the Masonic passport diploma from John Yarker, the same person who set Helen Blavatsky in motion to get the Nazi Party going, Aryan supremacy. So Yarker gave Crowley this Masonic passport. Crowley wrote glowingly about this guy. They had all these connections. And then Crowley began the process of establishing, helping to further establish mysticism in throughout the European world. And his worker in this, in the beginning of this process, was Walter Duranty. So long-winded, but I think everyone who listens to me can see the analytic relationship, how important this is. This is technical historical analysis. How did Walter Duranty end up connected to Crowley and then and with the production of the mysticism, which would then be part of what was used to hoist the Nazi Party onto the German people, and then he be the guy to go to the Ukraine and deny a Holocaust? You see, Tim, you see why this is troubling? Because, you see, it's Holocaust denial, but this one looks like they were doing it first. So I think it needs a little scrutiny. So anyway, I'm sorry to be long-winded, and I hope that the analytic point isn't, you know, too vague. But I do think that that it's this long process from Palmerston, 1842, all the way through the Ukrainian Holocaust that all of these events are related. They're all the, it's all the same group behind the scenes, you know, orchestrating chess pieces. And so this is another reason why the Holocaust as a cultural event needs some more sunlight put on it.
Yeah. You mentioned certain frauds, and it's interesting that it just wasn't done in the context of Holocaust denial, but there was the lawsuit between Anne Frank's father and the alleged or claimed ghostwriter for her, her diaries. And in the 1960s, there was a trial, and in the process of the of this trial, this lawsuit, it was revealed that the her diary was written mostly in ballpoint pen. Ballpoint pen wasn't invented until 1951. She supposedly died in 1944 in Bergen-Belsen. So. Now, this is an example of sort of crass profiteering because he made a fortune off her book and everyone reads this book. This is an example of something, again, it's a narrative, a story that's given to many people. School children still read this as a fact, as a proof of the Holocaust narrative and these things. Same way they watch movies like The Boy in the Striped Pajamas or Schindler's List and these things. But it's pretty much now it's been exposed that although Anne Frank's experience might be based in some truth, the book that was based on her diaries were fraudulent to make money and support a certain narrative of those events. But it's funny how that was exposed. I think it was a German lab did the forensics on the notebooks and came to that conclusion. Just because it wasn't done in the context of Holocaust denial, they were able to publish those findings. So that's an interesting story. Again, another example.
I was amazed by that. Yeah. And it came out in like 2016. He brought forward the idea that it was a fraud. And he said, look, it's ballpoint pen. And then they denied this. And they said, no, it's not ballpoint pen. But then somehow the father evidently spilled the beans or something. I forget exactly how it came about, but in 2016, it turned out that Otto Frank had been one of the writers of the thing.
Yeah, it was. I think it was a sealed court hearing in Germany.
Yeah,
or maybe court in New York, I think. And what happened was, and then they ended up settling out of court, but then it was leaked decades later.
Right. That's right. And so. But, you know, people say, well, I mean, you know, obviously, what does that mean? Anne Frank had a terrible time and we can still relate to her as a victim of the German war. Well, OK, great. But it's another, you know, technical part of the story that creates intimidation that does need a little bit of, a little more scrutiny. Right. Because, you see, it's very troubling, and it just sort of begs the question about, well, what's real? I mean, to me, if anyone's really like curious about, well, is there propaganda? I mean, just look at the video of when they go into Buchenwald and the shrunken heads.
Yeah,
this is just ludicrous. I mean, no one can understand these shrunken heads as anything other than Amazonian natives.
Or the lampshades, right, made of human skin.
Or the lampshade is just preposterous. Yeah. You know? And so this is, I mean, there it is. Propaganda is in play. The question is how far it's in play. You know, where does the propaganda end and the historical reality begin? If people start down the process, then I think almost automatically what happens is the Holocaust loses the cultural power of intimidation and propaganda. And then where are we? Well, I think we're frankly in a world where people can think more clearly.
Yeah. And, you know, even if you take Anne Frank's story where she's caught in 1944 in the Netherlands and she's shipped to Auschwitz, so supposed final destination, then the death camp. But the reality was she left Auschwitz and she was transported west to Belsen, where she eventually died of typhus, which so many died of typhus during the war in camps and outside the camps because of the lice and the conditions of the war and the conditions of the camps, which were worsened by the war when Germany started to collapse. Her economy collapsed in 44, 45. Obviously, conditions were horrible throughout Germany. They can be horrible within the camps, and they got worse as Germany's war situation became more desperate in late 44, 45. But her death follows the counter narrative many cite that many of the deaths in the camps were a product of the declining conditions of the camp due to the war itself. And remember, conditions throughout Europe became worse and worse because of the war, and particularly in Germany because of the Allied bombing campaign, the destruction of railroad transport roads and these things, water treatment and these things. So this was going to create the very conditions that the Allies eventually used as propaganda against the Germans to justify their brutal war. You know, their firebombing campaign and these things to sort of obscure, cover up their own crimes, like Eisenhower's, the so-called Eisenhower death camps, their Rhine-Meadow camps, where they had no excuse because there was ample food and supplies to feed the Germans, and they were intentionally left exposed to elements, not given proper shelter or food and water, and hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions and millions. Captured soldiers died under the care of the other allied, under the allied military and the U.S. military, French and British military, which is a war crime. But that doesn't get the press. So you have other, problems like Elie Wiesel, who has largely been exposed as kind of a profiteer and a fraud. But still, nevertheless, the media still loved him. But he was never, I don't believe he was able to manifest his tattoo, but he claimed that he was in Auschwitz, and of course he told these harrowing stories, what he witnessed, and of course what he tells are absurd. He says babies were being thrown into fire and these things, and he could, and I think in his book Night, he talks about you could tell, you know, who was being killed by the color of the flames and these things. None of these conditions existed in Auschwitz, but he himself admits that in early 1945, as the Russians were approaching, that he was given the option of staying behind and being liberated by the Red Army, or leaving with his German tormentors and with his father. He left with his sick father with the Germans. Now, if he was being victimized by the Germans to the point, you know, they're being annihilated, why would he leave with them? It doesn't make any sense. So obviously, they probably feared the Red Army, as so many Germans did. But that doesn't fit the narrative. It complicates the story, right? It creates moral ambiguity in these things. So the story persisted, and he was able to, win medals and make $100,000 speech in these things and sell his books in these things. So again, it's a lot of it's just, if you do apply any critical thought to it, it's absurd. And pretty soon, one story after another, you start to look at the book, the whole picture, and say, well, how much of this is even true? Is there another explanation for these things? And just a little critical thought, if you're not afraid, not intimidated, you can kind of understand these things. And it takes time to read about the war and the complexities, what goes on in warfare and these things. You understand how so many people can die, but that's not necessarily a deliberate, single central plan, for which there's no evidence. Remember, given the enormity of the supposed final solution, you would think there'd be mountains of documents and evidence, requisition forms, fuel requests, and these things to carry out these things, to fuel the ovens and these things. Doesn't exist.
Wouldn't there be mountains of bodies?
Bodies? That's another thing, is that where are the bodies? And there's nothing. You have the Allied reconnaissance aircraft, a photograph of these areas. You don't see smoke, billowing smoke that we hear about. You don't see the lines and these things. There's nothing in the evidence. And even when they broke the German military code, the Enigma machines broke the code, the Allies were listening to SS communications. There's no mention of it. So we'd have to believe that this plan was carried out by word of mouth and code word and through inferences and euphemisms, which is ridiculous on its face. However, the other explanation were the use of slave labor, often brutal, the declining conditions in the camp, the people dying on transport in the trains. These things are believable in the context of the war, but they don't necessarily prove a final solution plan. And all these conditions would have existed, like in Russia, their slave labor camps, these things, or in the Japanese. You have, again, I mentioned the Rhinemeadow camps that the Allies ran afterward, just after the war. But you had, hundreds of thousands of people interred in the United States, put in the camps. Now, the United States didn't face economic and physical collapse. They weren't being bombed back to the Stone Age. So the condition in those camps for the Japanese internees weren't nearly as bad as were those who were held in German camps. But I would suspect if the Japanese were firebombing New York and Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., and conditions were, people were starving to death, and the railroads didn't work anymore because they had been bombed and destroyed, the treatment for the Japanese in those camps would have been pretty bad, probably, and they would have been first to starve because they would have been last to get the food.
That you can have death in a concentration camp without the idea of the final solution.
Yeah, you can
as part of the...
You can even have arbitrary executions.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Things, yeah. War is a difficult thing. It starts out with political goals and then tends to just become mayhem.
And they get things like restatements of some Nazis about, like Goebbels, his about right. Annihilating Jews and these things. Well, Eisenhower talked about annihilating Germans. And you have, Morgenthau plan. I mean, the irony is the only existing document for planning for annihilation of entire people was an Allied document, the Morgenthau Plan, which is interesting because it was through the Department of the Treasury. Hans Morgenthau was the Secretary of the Treasury, but he ran the War Refugee Office. And it was through that prism or through that window that all the information came into the United States during the war about the Holocaust through his assistant, Harry Dexter White, who was a Jewish communist. So there's your source.
Yeah.
And what we know of the Holocaust, all the pictures we have are from the Western camps, which have been largely debunked, right? The stories we get are from the East, and the source of which are the Soviet Union, or the Soviets, not a trustworthy source. So what do we have for the evidence? For the official narrative. Again, we're not saying that bad things didn't happen, that people weren't brutalized, starved to death, and they treated poorly. And these, obviously, in the context of the war, slave labor, these things, Jews were targeted as enemy people, the same way the Japanese in the United States were targeted, and the West Coast were targeted as potential enemies of the state for the war. And they're going to be treated accordingly. And like I said, given the conditions that Germany suffered in the latter half of the war, it really isn't too surprising that so many people would suffer in those camps as overall conditions in Germany collapsed or got worse.
I think that if we start a technical analysis of those elements, that what you end up with is no real kind of conclusion. You'd never be able to really find the truth, but you would see that there wasn't any evidence for assertion, for the idea, well, here is the Holocaust, 6 million people, finally, that wouldn't exist. You would not be able to say, well, was there no mistreatment of Jews, no murdering of Jews, no camps that kept them? No, I don't think you could get there. And I think that it's, you have to, because like, as you know, I believe that this World War II was basically an orchestrated event. So I've been asked by people to say, well, you mean that they just didn't kill any Jews and just, yeah. Right. No, I don't think so. I think these guys are perfectly able to sacrifice, 100,000 people, of even if they are of their own race, in order to create the historical structure. I think these guys play that black and that dirty.
Oh yeah, I mean, you needed the suffering to advance the Zionist project.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and the idea that, well, there were no Jews killed at Warsaw. No, I don't think so. I think there probably were hundreds and thousands, and there probably were a lot of Jews that were trapped in the firebombing even. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it mattered. I think that, in the broad stroke, they were getting what they wanted. And the broad stroke had aspects to it that they could then use as the basis for the propaganda. But so this is the thing, is that the analysis of the Holocaust, one of the reasons why they have to work so hard to stop it from getting started, is it'll break out, Tim. If it gets going, you'll see that, just sort of like 9-1-1. I mean, once it gets going, people will start wondering about all of the creation of the Nazi Party. I mean, the stuff that we talk about will start, people start scratching their heads and going, well, wait a second. Who was Hitler? Where did this come from? Once you start opening your mind up, there are so many elements of the historical narrative that are either completely disprovable or are basically unclear, that you end up with just vapor. There isn't any historical narrative in the way we've been giving it.
Yeah.
And so then, the good news, we are free. Our minds are free. We can start evaluating cultures and ethnic power, and we can see whether or not groups are enslaving us a little more clearly. Bad news is, well, we've lost, one of the sort of the linchpins, the anchors of our mind, because the Holocaust is, it's part of our ability to enjoy films like Schindler's List.
Well, that's where you get so much resistance, because you're denying people. It's tough enough to deny people their heroes. You deny them their villains, and they get real emotional.
Yeah.
And not just Jews. It's people in general, because they get very uncomfortable. And this is kind of like it's a reference point. It's something they can stand on that helps them understand their view of the world and the past and their place in their country's place in it. Americans take a great pride in the triumphalism of World War II. We liberated Europe. We saved Europe twice in the last century. Europe owes us. There's wimps in Europe. And even in Russia today, where the myth of the Second World War forms the basis for legitimacy of the Russian state, which is why there are laws
exactly
in
right.
Russia which ban Holocaust revisionism. You know, it's not denial, it's revisionism. And everything needs to be revised and rethought in these things. These are complex events. There isn't one, I guess theoretically out there is the truth. The only problem is, as human beings, we have perspectives. And so there's different perspectives for these events, and there's different interests and understandings of these events. World War II is very different to a Jew than it is to an Indian who experienced it. Right, it's very different if you're Irish in World War II than if you're British, or if you're German, if you're Russian, if you're an American. It was a huge war, so there's going to be different perspectives and complex understandings of these things, and different motivations for fighting. A good example: why would Russians fight against the Soviet government, like Václav's army? Because many Russians didn't like Stalin, and when these Russians were teaming up with the Germans to fight Stalin, they didn't see themselves as traitors. They were hoping that they would get some sort of, reprieve if they helped the Russians take out Stalin. Why would so many Ukrainians take part in the slaughter of Jews in the Ukraine? Well, if you look at what happened, why would so many Ukrainians join the SS battalions in the Ukraine? Was it because they're evil? Well, no. It's the context of the 1930s. Many of the executioners, Stalin's executioners in the Ukraine in the 1930s, were Jewish.
Right.
The NKVD was dominated by Jews in the Ukraine. Kaganovich.
Well, the Bolsheviks were just 98% Jews, and somehow they've got Stalin, the guy who has all of the pictures of him with the hidden hand, as a Christian leader, right? Which is sort of head-scratching, since all of the people underneath him were Jews, but yet, nevertheless,
and
the Stalin character come forward, and then he's the one who then... sweeps in to wipe out the German population from the east.
And here's the irony, because if you project into the future, go forward in the future, just a few years ago, right now, Ukraine, when NATO is trying to unseat the pro-Russian government in the Ukraine, install, the pro-Western government, which is Nazi, and you have neocon Jews supporting Nazis in the Ukraine. This is the cynicism. Now, this is very interesting, because historically, Zionists have been very willing to work with Nazis. And if you think about the Hovara or the transfer agreement, where Nazi Germany set up with Zionists to help transport and set up the financing to develop Israel to get the Jews out of Germany. This was, the SS and the Zionists had the same objective there: a Germany free of Jews. Both the Zionists and the SS wanted that. But you have like very very awkward things. They have a letter by, I think it was Yitzhak Shamir, praising the Third Reich.
Yeah, the thing is that
the
evidence, and again, people they scratch their head and they go, well, what is the meaning of this? Well, what it means is the same people who are setting up the Nazi Party are trying to create the State of Israel.
Yeah.
Which shouldn't surprise anyone who has bothered to trace back the aspects of the Nazi Party past the Tool Society, the Wotan group, into the Theosophical Society, into the Quattro Coronati, and then suddenly you're there with the elite Jewish banking families and the British royal family and the elite Freemasons. So now, this is something that I get a lot of criticism for, is because people say, well, you're attacking Hitler. And I say, no, these are people who actually, have the idea that Hitler, they see the Jewish power.
Yeah, he was a white knight holding the past.
He was like fighting against it. And I really want you to think about Hitler in a different way. Hitler, to me, it seems like an artificial creation of the same group that brought about the other elements, in the period between 1900 and 1940. I just don't think that, if you look at all of the elements that lead up to Hitler, and then you look at this character, that he makes any sense. And then the idea that he would then go forward and, believe in total war as his juxtaposed to Winston Churchill's same position, that then would lead to this complete annihilation of the German people. How about looking at Hitler as part of the plan? You see, how about that piece of analysis? Because remember, oddly enough, once again, where's the evidence? Well, he disappears after World War II, strangely enough. Mm-hmm. So, again, can you prove this? No, but I can sure make a strong analytic case for this. And I can sure make a strong analytic case that, you really shouldn't find any heroism in people that on some kind of personal principle like Hitler had will permit a genocide of the people that he's supposed to be leading, you see. So there is no reason whatsoever to try to find anything heroic in this character any more than there is in Winston Churchill, FDR, Stalin. I mean, what you need to do is to bring analytic force against this guy to figure out, well, how did he participate in the Holocaust of the European? How was it that this individual came to be? And then the next thing you know, you suddenly had, I mean, the numbers are just so catastrophic, it's you can't even, I mean, you know, and I was thinking about that, you know, you had the Ukrainian Holocaust, you had the German Holocaust, and then in World War I, you had the French Holocaust, right? Because you had Verdun and all this. So basically, the period between like 1917 and 1945 were just three Holocausts of the European, all of them in the tens of millions. The culture never was able to regenerate itself, you know, to any political power because it's been controlled. We'll talk about that, I guess, next week about NATO, but. So the, you know, this just goes to the idea of once you start the process of analysis, you know, you can't hold on to, you know, these icons, you know, that are related to a narrative that you don't really understand or there's no evidence to support, or there's even any real understanding about the individual. You know, I mean, Hitler is just, to me, he's a completely artificial creation. He is the world religious leader that the Theosophical Society envisioned, Helen Blavatsky, who is going to lead the Aryans to Aryan supremacy. You know, I mean, I just think it's as obvious that this is where the guy with the Masonic swastika comes from. Not circumstance, that this would be just impossible to imagine. And so the whole war was fake. And, you know, when you look at the Holocaust in this light, then you start questioning things and the technical analysis starts. And then the Holocaust just becomes part of the whole process by which you end up with a mind that can think clearly. You know, Tim, we may not be able to reverse everything, but I do think we can move to a point where we can think more clearly and more freely, don't you? If someone absorbs information and the things that we're talking about, you know, what can happen to them? Well, I'm not sure, but I know one thing, and that's they will be freer. They'll be freer to think clearly. And that's the valuable thing. And if they do, then just one last thing, you know, use a mind that thinks more clearly to stand up to the intimidation. It should be self-evident that once you start, you know, the technical analysis of the Holocaust, that this is another thing that needs people to stand up and say, well, wait a second. I want to talk about this. No, I'm not afraid. I don't, you know, now you might get fired. You might be arrested. But nevertheless, this is sometimes, you know, when you want to live in truth, you just have to take some chances. There has to be a way to talk about it. I've been able to talk about the Holocaust and Holocaust kind of the new questions with people who are, you know, basically just hate Holocaust deniers. And there are ways to do it, but it's real tricky. But nevertheless, just got to do. You have to find a way to do it because this is what freedom of mind requires.
Yeah. And, well, what type of truth requires the threat of imprisonment?
Yeah.
And, good question. And what is wrong with just, you know, asking the question, say, where is the evidence? Have you really scrutinized these claims, or you just swallowed them hook, line, and sinker because that's what you've been told? And most people just, you know, they accept what they're told in these things. They have a, you know, the university professor tells them this, so they read it. You know, they watch the History Channel, they watch the documentary, they've seen movies. You know, how could this be so? And, I mean, if you look at things like you're asking what these wars and the role, you know, what this Hitler figure really represent, why was he put, you know, installed, and how'd the war break out and these things. Well, you know, this conflict over the Danzig Corridor breaks out in this huge global conflagration. Is that just an accident? And look at World War One. Okay, you have this assassination in Sarajevo, and then almost by, you know, just, you know, one country goes to war after another. No one had the decency or the foresight to say, this, let's stop this. This is insane. Well, why is that? Are people that insane or that stupid? No, I don't think so. I think you sent me an email about World War One.
Yeah.
About, you know, this sort of this Freemasonic project just to get the armies clashing together to wipe the European generation out. Well, that seems, I mean, looking at it, I mean, just as opposed to this war by times tables like World War One, where you have these alliance process, you have these various alliances and treaties that just the situation just lost, you know, people lost control of the situation. And the same thing with World War Two. Each stage of the game, you have, if you really look at the history, you have, you know, the Western powers sort of undermining or creating conditions in countries like Germany or Russia or even Japan, and then being needlessly confrontational and not really creating the conditions of an eventual conflict. You know, like U.S. policy vis-a-vis Japan in 1941, 1940 and these things. Or, you know, Great Britain with Germany throughout the 1930s, you know, help ushering Hitler in their power. Is just an accident, you know?
Well, I mean, the email I sent you was really just eye-opening. And I hope that, I mean, I got the information from a very reliable source, person that sends me information. In other areas, he's just been as accurate as can be. I wasn't able to do any more research other than what he had sent me, and I sent the pass along the information to you, but I think it is correct, and I'm going to pass it along to our listeners because it's so important. When you had the event which began World War II, which was when Archduke Franz Ferdinand was assassinated, you know, by this anarchist, who was, of course, you know, basically related to British Freemasonry, the Archduke was in a car. And what this individual pointed out to me was that the license plate was A111118. Now this strikes me, and I do believe this is correct, and I hope people, if I am not correct, will correct me. But my research has indicated this is correct, and I was sent it by someone who is an actual historian.
That's so true. That's interesting. That's like David Rockefeller is watch 9/11.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Because the fact is that Armistice Day, or A, occurred at, you know, November 11th, 1918. So the idea that the license plate would be 111118 is not possible to be circumstantial, particularly when you see that the Freemasons are so, you know, I mean, just the fact that the war ended on November 11th is obviously a little suspicious, but the idea that the license plate was 111118 shows, I mean, basically what they were saying is, you know, this is a foreshadowing, you know, this divine foreshadowing that they love to bring about deliberately of when the war, we were going to conclude our war. And so, and this doesn't surprise me at all because, you know, I think that the plan has, you know, goes back into the first century. And I think the idea was always to get control over the political, media, financial systems. And as soon as they did and had technologic weapons developed enough, they were going to destroy the European populations. And that's why when Palmerston said in 1842 that now is the time that the Jews need to return to the homeland, I think he was basically announcing that they had enough political control to execute the plan. And then when you get to this, you know, the Archduke Franz Ferdinand's execution, that the fact that they had A111118, I mean, it shows that they really do have a good grip on basically the political powers. So because they could foresee, just like Martin Luther King foresaw his death. I mean, here, you know, whoever had the car that picked up poor Archduke Ferdinand, you know, he's just very lucky, Tim, that, you know, that he got one that had a, you know, license plate that foreshadowed what was about to occur. So, you know, there it is.
Yeah, didn't he also make a wrong turn and circle back towards the assassin or something?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it just, you know, the whole thing just sort of breaks down. There he is in his car with A111118. You know, I mean, it's just anyone who has the eyes to see should be able to look at that and go, nah, that's not circumstance. We're looking at a, you know, World War One is clearly a pageant. And I remember it was Eustace Mullins, I believe, who said that he talked about a nurse who came across the Allies giving food to the Germans during World War One, with the idea of just keeping the war going on longer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then she put a letter in this nurse's journal saying what she had seen. She was arrested or captured by the Germans and executed. The only nurse to have
had. Yeah, I remember that story. Yeah,
right. That story, which I don't have the capacity to vet, but I do think Mullins would not be blowing smoke. So this again shows foreknowledge of the conclusion of the war. Right, they actually have the date in mind. So the war is basically, as I've been saying about World War II, this is a pageant. This is a Freemason religious pageant.
And look what they've done with Armistice Day. When Armistice Day was used to be sort of a lament, a sorrowful look at the cost of the war. And this was sort of the mindset in the general public, at least in America, probably in France and Britain too. That they had been had, that the war, you know, this is the investigation, the war profiteering, the merchants of death hearings in the 30s and these things. So there's a broad-based understanding that the war had been a fraud, a needless sacrifice, and a disaster. And then they turned it into Veterans Day, I think after World War II. And now it's sort of it's a glorification of war because we honor the sacrifice that people for our country, supposedly.
For freedom.
Right. And so this is part of that sort of that neurolinguistic programming, the mind control, where instead of lamenting the war, you glorify it. And as someone once said, we perpetuate war by glorifying its sacrifices. And that's why they build monuments.
Right. Exactly right. The propaganda works in all directions, and the Holocaust is being used as part of it. And so, you know, look, the license plate, it could not be circumstance. We're looking at a fake narrative. The idea the war is there, you know, organically is incorrect. The Masons are in control of both sides of the political structure. Given that, it's trivial. It's very easy to keep the armies frozen in place until they slaughter the appropriate.
Well, people think that something as complex or as vast as, say, the Great War, the First World War, could be orchestrated and more or less be grim theater, you know, sort of a grim theater, is preposterous. Well, I mean, look how easily the public is tricked into participating in the slaughter by very crude propaganda. I mean, you know, paintings of the Germans as a monkey, right?
Holding a blonde.
Holding a blonde woman.
And the Bohemian Grove guy. Food propaganda to get fire people up to you know, I'm going over there to fight.
I mean, was Germany really going to come over and conquer the United States? Was the war really there to defend democracy? And but people buy into this propaganda, so it's very. I mean, society is very easily moved and manipulated, especially when the government has the means of mass communication and propaganda.
It controls the media. I mean, this is the thing. So when Palmerston said now is the time. He was saying now is the time because we have control over the political system and the media, and so we can just make sure that we can execute this destruction of the entire European population.
Well, this is why something
and
like...
We're not doing it because we can control the media. We can come up with explanations as to why we've got to hold the armies in place. And remember, you know, you had the Freemason generals in Britain. I don't have the stats on the German side, but I actually am getting this, and I'm thinking that it can be shown it's completely Masonic on both sides of the line.
Well, it's like if you look at it from a means of control, it gets us back to C.D. Jackson and Time Life and Dachau and the Holocaust narrative and the fakery that's now acknowledged that the shrunken heads, the lampshades, fake, the gas chambers, at least in Belsen, fake, you know, in Dachau, fake. Never existed. That's acknowledged. That's the official narrative now. So the official narrative is a revision, just not something you're. They just kind of shifted it east, where there's no photographic evidence, just claims. But this is CD Jack, Time Life, and these things, and they're the ones that publish pictures of like a baby crying in Shanghai when the Japanese bombed Shanghai, and there's a baby crying in the smoldering ruins, and we now know that the baby was placed there.
Yeah.
Now this isn't really, to say that Japanese
care about crying like Asian babies.
Yeah, no one cares.
When we drop atomic bombs on cities that have nothing but women and children in them, right? You can see it's so logical that we would.
See, this is how illogical it is, because then what about Hamburg or Tokyo or Dresden, right? But no, it's this one crying baby, and the same way that the Iwo Jima Memorial. The photograph that it's modeled after. The photograph was staged.
Yeah. I mean, that's why, last week I was talking about the stupidest generation until my generation, but the World War II guys were just horribly duped. And not just, in the run-up to the war, but then after the war, the whole atomic bomb thing, where they just got systematically duped, and no one in our generation or in that generation was able to really reach the public with the information that, look, we're being lied to. The person that actually set out to do that was Patton. I don't know if you've seen the letters that he wrote, following the end of the war when he was still in Europe, and he was complaining about basically the Semitic power in the media and the U.S. government that was creating a slave state in Germany and wiping out the German prisoners and so he actually said that he was going to try to do something about that. And then, of course, he was killed. So, but absent Patton, who else was really there at the end of World War II to try to make the American public question the narrative, to make them say, well, gee, do we really need to drop the atomic bombs? Did we really need to firebomb Hamburg? It just goes back right into the narrative about the Holocaust. If you start that process, just starting it is all you need, and then you're outside of the mind control, and now you're a dangerous person to the world order because you're thinking. Mm-hmm. So they'll try to keep these narratives in place. We had to use nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki because a million troops would have died,
Yeah.
It's just ludicrous. Zero troops would have died. The Japs would have surrendered in a week if they just, started them out. So no one had to die in that situation.
Yeah, they had already sued for peace, so.
Of course. They'd already contacted the Russians, trying to figure out how to do it. And so, I think it was Halsey, I believe it was one of the admirals, the chief admirals in the Navy. He said that, there was no military reason to do the bombing. The Japs were already beaten and they were trying to surrender. And this is like, I think it was Halsey. I'll have to check my read, but it was maybe Nimitz, but it was one of the very top admirals who had access to all the information. He said that, no, the scientists had this toy. And they wanted to set it off. See, he actually describes the fact that the group that controlled the atomic bomb, which was, of course, developed in the Bohemian Grove, right? Mm-hmm. That this group was somehow outside of the control of the military. He says it. He says, if you look at the words carefully, he says, the scientists had, they had this toy. And we needed to, they needed to set it off. And so I actually have the quote here. I wonder if I can find it. Because it was just really, okay, so here it is. Let me just see if I can read this to you. This was, it was Halsey. And he said the scientists had this toy and they wanted to try it out, so they dropped it. It killed a lot of Japs, but the Japs had put out peace sealers through the Russians long before. That's Admiral William Halsey. And remember, at this time, the intelligence gathering was coming through military commanders to the president, not like now where you have like the secret society, CIA. This is before the CIA. The intelligence concerning the nature of, what's going on in Japan Halsey has as good an understanding of it as anything. He's the commander of the U.S. fleet,
yeah,
for God's sakes. He knows what's going on. But it wasn't just Halsey. I mean, I don't know
so, if she's... Admiral Leahy, Truman's chief of staff, said it was unnecessary,
I mean, Nimitz said the atomic bomb played no decisive part. Even Curtis LeMay, who was, you know, completely insane and just, you know, he was just this bomb everyone. He said the war had been over in 2 weeks without the Russians entering and without the atomic bomb. Because everyone knew that there were no military targets left in Japan. So this, you know, maybe it's slightly far afield from the subject of the Holocaust, but not really, because you see, it shows that the socialization... fake narrative, right, was being developed on the entire war. The Holocaust is just part of the fake narrative to create the citizen who, you know, sees himself as part of the greatest generation, you know, Veterans Day, where we're honoring the great sacrifice that we made. Look, people, we were fooled into slaughtering ourselves,
mm-hmm.
right? That's what happened. And so... This is what you know, when these events come up, what needs to be brought to the people is that the government is creating mind control to keep the public from understanding that the secret society used the wars to reduce their population. There's nothing to celebrate. And the veterans who died is tragic, but they were not heroes. They were dupes. They were sacrificial lambs. The Holocaust was the Holocaust of the European.
Yeah, the one true Holocaust was the war itself, where 60, 70 million souls, you know, people perished. That was, you know, and we're supposed to focus on allegedly a small percentage and see that it's somehow worse. So many people suffered and died in that war, and there's a lot of misery to go around, and they aren't protected, nor are they given any payments, you know. From the German state, from the German government, for their suffering.
They just handed out some money last week, I saw. They keep handing out money. They keep finding more survivors.
Yeah, it's incredible how many survivors. I mean,
considering that there was this final solution, but man, these guys keep coming out of the woodwork, and they each get like $1 million for having, you know.
Well, all you have to do to be a Holocaust survivor is be in Europe and be Jewish at the time, and you're considered a Holocaust.
I was looking at it, and it's like one guy said, like, Hitler, you know, wrote a bad check on my account for like $80 or something, and he gave him $2 million. I mean, it's just the whole thing is preposterous. Look, let us stop with the intimidation. Stop it. It's just a waste. It does. Where are we going to go? We're heading right off a cliff. Let's just, start to talk among ourselves about these things. Start to create, to the extent we can, an end to the intimidation. You know, like I've been saying, Tim, the people, they if they listen to us and they get it and they go, gee, it makes a lot of sense, seems like correct. Okay, how to rebel? Just start talking.
Yeah, and it reveals the fact that our institutions, these things are based on power preservation, these things not on truth, and there's no dedication to truth or free thought or free inquiry in these things. And that, to me, that's the indictment, that we're being sold a bill of goods or lies when they have to resort to, well, one thing, imprisonment, to intimidation, to the point where you say one thing that isn't acceptable, and you're out of a job, and you become ostracized. And what are you afraid of? What, you afraid of the truth?
Well, that's exactly right. The reason the biggest indictment against the reality of how they express the Holocaust, the fact that they have to put lies out to keep people from talking about it. It's axiomatic. I think what happened, we were talking before the show that they probably these guys are specialists in mind control. They recognize that the narrative, how weak it was, right? They looked at it and go, gee, this doesn't look like it can really stand up. There's all these 6 million number used before World War II, and God knows what's going to happen if people get into the, you know, Montague Norman and the funding of the Nazi Party with the Warburg family. If this stuff comes out, I mean, it's just going to, you know, where it'll end.
Yeah, the Warburg family owns IG Farben.
Right. They're the board. It was just ludicrous. So this is why the laws came out.
Well, Joe?
Yeah.
In a few weeks, I believe there's a movie coming out about Eichmann starring, what's his name? Sir. Ben Kingsley. He plays.
Is he
Eichmann.
Playing Eichmann?
I think he plays Eichmann. I think Eichmann was too young, but anyway, I think Eichmann was in his late 30s.
In the trial, he was. Well, I mean, it depends which part of the life he shows. I mean, they have the trial when he was older. But
yeah, but there's a new movie coming out, which I'm sure it's going to be nominated for Academy Award.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, you know, they could have a twin bill with Spike Lee's new Lampoon of David Duke.
Yeah.
So you could just have a real hate the European twin bill. You know, it's like, gee, this is really going to help make, help with clear-minded thinking about our historical narrative, right? Won't it? You know, with the David Duke Lampoon movie, and here comes Eichmann again. God, do they roll these guys out, you know?
And Eichmann's very interesting because Eichmann was involved in Hervara, the transfer agreement. And he had a lot of dealings with Zionists before the war and during the war. And some people suggest that his kidnapping in Argentina in 1962 and subsequent trial and execution was to sort of tie up a loose end about some of the seedier dealings between Jewish organizations in the Third Reich in the run-up to the war and even during the war.
Yeah, I know. I mean, of course, I'm even worse. I always wonder about the reality of any of this. It seemed to me like it's pretty. I just now, in hindsight, I look at the whole thing as fake, and I don't even know who this Eichmann character really was. You know, they had so many. You know, there's so many Mason lifetime actors in the Third Reich that you just can't trust. You know, up from down. There's no way to vet any of this. So we can analytically be certain that the whole thing is a fraud. And we can be certain that there's a lot of people involved that are unreal and they're just fooling us. I mean, we know that, the Warburg family weren't really afraid of the Nazi party because they were funding them. So, you know, so where does it stop? Who knows? It's impossible. We can only go as far as our analytic logic can take us. And it takes us far enough. It takes us to the point where we're out of the mind control. We know enough now to know that we don't need to suffer from that. And hopefully go forward and shatter the intimidation.
Yep. Okay, Joe, think we covered it?
I think we have, sir.
Okay.
Thank you so much, and we'll talk soon.
Talk in a few days. Enjoy the weekend.
Okay. Bye, Tim.
Yeah, bye-bye. Yeah.